Yay.
So, well, great. Well, Marcy, looks like we'll have you back then. In the meantime, if people want to find out about the Central Oregon Coast trans community, can you tell us one more time where do they go on to find that?
Facebook. We have both public and private page. Yeah, Facebook is where you can contact, or you can friend me, but send me a little message. Let me know what it is that I can do to help you.
And you're doing your Zoom meetings, and those are posted on the Facebook as well?
Zoom meetings are posted on Facebook. We usually post them the day of or the day before, but they are posted. Yes, and that's every other Wednesday.
Well, thank you, Marcy. I
Excellent.
think we'll have you back then in November and do a two-parter. So thank you so much for joining us tonight.
So good to see you, girl.
Thank you. You too.
One, two, three, one. The light goes down.
Portland.
This is Takimba, the host of the Melting Pot Radio Show. During these crazy times of COVID and social distancing, KBOO Radio and its connection to community are more valuable than ever. It's important to hear real news during the day that keeps you up to speed with what is actually going on in the world, and we continue to provide musical entertainment throughout the evenings to take your mind off the troubles of the world while giving you something positive to focus on. The Melting Pot Radio Show has just hit our 12-year anniversary, and we continue to support KBOO throughout the years because it's such a valuable resource which is slipping away from us in so many cities around the country. KBOO has been around for 50 years and continues to grow with support from listeners like you. You can go to kboo.fm/give to support KBOO right now.
From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, President Donald Trump on Monday left Walter Reed Military Hospital after only 3 days of treatment for COVID-19. In a staged and heavily covered ceremony, Trump exited the facility wearing a mask, and upon arriving at the White House, took his mask off for cameras, even though he was, by all accounts, deeply contagious and his every breath carried a virus load. He then gave a brief address urging people to not be afraid of the deadly disease.
And I learned so much about coronavirus. And one thing that's for certain, don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it. And you're going to beat it. I didn't feel so good. And 2 days ago, I could have left 2 days ago. 2 days ago, I felt great, like better than I have in a long time. I said just recently, better than 20 years ago. Don't let it dominate. Don't let it take over your lives. Don't let that happen. We have the greatest country in the world. We're going back. We're going back to work. We're going to be out front. As your leader, I had to do that. I knew there's danger to it, but I had to do it. I stood out front. I led. Nobody that's a leader would not do what I did. And I know there's a risk, there's a danger, but that's okay. And now I'm better, and maybe I'm immune, I don't know. But don't let it dominate your lives. Get out there, be careful. We have the best medicines in the world, and it all happened very shortly, and they're all getting approved, and the vaccines are coming momentarily.
Trump's speech caused consternation among doctors and family members of those who've died from the disease. One scientist wrote on Twitter, "What White House staffer would still want to go to work tomorrow? Epidemiologists just want to vomit." Another pointed out that Trump was visibly making a serious effort to breathe as he stood for the cameras. Many have pointed out the risks that Trump is putting his own staff at, with the writer for The Guardian saying, quote, "The bodyguards are there to take a bullet for the president, not to take one from him." But that was, in effect, what Trump was demanding they do for a photo op. Two White House housekeepers have already tested positive for the disease. None of the support staff that are expected to serve the president are likely to have the high-quality treatment Trump has access to. More than 200,000 Americans have lost their lives to coronavirus, and many family members who lost loved ones say they're outraged at the president's cavalier behavior. The organization COVID Survivors for Change released a statement saying, "For the long haulers living with symptoms of COVID-19 for months on end, this virus is terrifying. Trump doesn't care, and he still doesn't get what families are going through." The group organized an installation of 20,000 empty lawn chairs in front of the White House, one for every 10 people who've died in the U.S. from the virus. Meanwhile, Trump has continued to spread misinformation on social media, and on Monday, Twitter took down one of his tweets, saying that it violated their policies, and then put it back up, saying that it may be in the public's interest for the tweet to remain accessible. In it, Trump equated the coronavirus to the seasonal flu, even though COVID death rates are twice that of the flu. According to a new CNN poll, two-thirds of Americans feel that Trump was irresponsible about his illness and infection. According to the outlet, disapproval of the president's handling of the coronavirus outbreak stands at a new high in the survey, with 60% saying they disapprove. Additionally, 63% say his own infection is unlikely to change anything about the way that he handles the pandemic. Shockingly, the White House gift shop on Monday began taking pre-orders of a $100 commemorative coin labeled "Trump Defeats COVID." As part of his continued politicization of the disease, the Trump administration this week has blocked the FDA's stringent guidelines for a vaccine to be approved, even as companies developing vaccines are in the middle of their trials, which are slated to extend past the election date. The Trump White House, in a desperate bid to have a vaccine released as a campaign event, has pushed to curtail the studies. The Rose Garden event, more than a week ago, which numerous infected people are known to have attended, is being viewed as a super spreader event. And yet, the White House is apparently making no effort to conduct a contact tracing program to control the spread of the virus from the event. New infections continue to pop up among those who attended, including the pastor of a mega church. Republican Senator Ron Johnson, who is among those infected, has echoed Trump's nonchalance, saying there is, quote, "unjustifiable hysteria over the disease." But Virginia's Democratic Governor Ralph Northam, who also tested positive and who's been quarantining himself, has taken the opposite approach, saying Trump was irresponsible to make his claims of being unafraid of COVID-19. Cases across the country are surging, and medical experts expect 2,900 Americans a day to be dying from it by December. Meanwhile, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, who has taken great pains to adhere to medical recommendations on COVID safety, has remained virus-free and has been able to continue campaigning. He said during a campaign visit to Florida that he wasn't surprised by the president's diagnosis. Biden's lead over Trump in the battleground state of Arizona has widened, where he now has 49% support compared to 41% for the president. A similar result in Michigan shows Biden leading Trump 48-39%. And in the swing states of Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, he leads Trump by 5 and 6 points, respectively. Nationally, Biden's lead has now grown to 16% over Trump. And Biden released a new and lengthy campaign ad featuring former First Lady Michelle Obama, making a 24-minute case for him as president. Here are some excerpts of her ad where she addressed Trump's failure on the pandemic and his use of racism to stoke fear.
7 months later, he still won't wear a mask consistently and encourage others to do the same, even when those simple actions could save countless lives. Because this is a difficult time, a confusing time. And when people hear these lies and crazy conspiracies repeated over and over and over again, they don't know what to think.
That's Michelle Obama urging a vote for Joe Biden. And a new report found that one quarter of all the media coverage of Kamala Harris being announced as Biden's VP candidate was racist or sexist. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday, in one of its first rulings of the new term, sided with Republicans in South Carolina who are insisting that mail-in ballots have a witness signature in order to be counted. In a case brought by a clerk who refused to issue a marriage license to a gay couple, conservative justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas appeared to question the 2015 ruling that affirmed the rights of same-sex couples to marry. In other news, the U.S. Senate has adjourned for 2 weeks due to the coronavirus pandemic that has infected at least 3 Republican lawmakers. The adjournment is scheduled around Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's fast-tracked timeline to confirm Judge Amy Coney Barrett as a new Supreme Court justice ahead of the November 3rd election. McConnell required unanimous consent in order to adjourn, and instead of using that as a chance to block his timeline, Democrats strangely assented. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has announced October 12th as a start date for Coney Barrett's hearings. A white Texas police officer has been arrested and charged with murder in the shooting death of a black man named Jonathan Price in Wolf City. Mr. Price was apparently shot after he intervened when he saw a man assault a woman. The officer shot Price while the victim was walking away. He has been booked into a county jail on a $1 million bail. And in 2 other incidents of officers killing black Americans, the family of Breonna Taylor in Kentucky has asked a new special prosecutor to reopen her case. And in Oakland, California, officials have reopened the case of the 2009 police killing of Oscar Grant. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up. It's on. Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Wednesday, October 7th marks the 19th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, the longest official war the U.S. has ever been in the modern era. The war is so long that some soldiers who served when the war first began are now seeing their own sons and daughters deploying to the same war. While peace talks are underway between the Taliban and the U.S.-backed Afghan government, violence still continues to plague the nation with relentless bombs and attacks from both domestic groups and outside countries like the U.S. But the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan goes back much further than 2001. It can be traced back to 1979, a year before the Soviet Union invaded that nation. And that history is in danger of now being rewritten. My guests are Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. They're longtime journalists and documentarians covering Afghanistan. They're the authors of Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, and Crossing Zero, the AFPAC War at the Turning Point of American Empire. Welcome to the program, Paul and Elizabeth.
Thank you, Sonali. Great to be here.
Let's first talk about what is happening right now. This war was supposed to have ended. Numerous presidents have tried to end it. There was a peace deal with the U.S., then there wasn't, then there was, and now there are supposedly peace talks between the Taliban and the U.S.-backed Afghan government that had initially been left out of peace talks. How do you characterize the current unfolding situation? Are we to mark the 20th anniversary next year, you think?
Please.
Yeah, well, I think every year that there's an anniversary, I think we go through the same routine of wondering why. And I think at some point you really have to look at the facts on the ground and say, there's no intention of ever solving this problem. And that's part of the history, part of the connection back. The Taliban actually was a creation of Pakistani intelligence. It never was actually a completely homegrown. There are Afghans involved in it, but the real power comes from the Pakistani intelligence. So you're looking at a situation that, once again, now it's very difficult to tell people, to explain to people, you know, why nothing ever seems to get solved. And so it seemed to me, and I think I would have to say it must seem to most Americans, that we're now in this is the 19th year, the 20th. I guess it really is going to be an issue of when the United States no longer can afford to be there any longer, and that's the only way we're going to leave.
And of course, the war has sucked up billions, trillions even, of U.S. dollars over the years. One of the issues is the legitimacy of the U.S.-backed Afghan government. After the U.S. initially overthrew the Taliban, it installed a man that many refer to as a puppet leader, Hamid Karzai, in Afghanistan. Today, the president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, also suffers from a sort of lack of legitimacy. And I'm wondering if you think that even leaving Afghanistan, whether the U.S.-backed Afghan government really is capable of, just because of the way in which it was set up, of continuing to rule Afghanistan?
I would imagine that the government would fall almost immediately. Mm-hmm. I think that in order to understand this, I mean, what we keep getting here in the United States is a snapshot view of history. And this is an ongoing history, and it very much involves that part of the world. Central Asia is a vitally important area of the geography of the world, certainly for Western interests, but for everybody else involved as well. And it's a crossroads. Afghanistan is a crossroads from the Middle East to Europe, to Asia, to Central Asia. It's a very important place. And Americans just don't get that kind of information. I mean, from the mainstream media. They get it from people like you, Sonali, but they don't get it from the mainstream media. And so that's why we're constantly short when it comes to information. It's similar to how we got involved in Vietnam in the first time. All of a sudden, it became a huge problem. And then suddenly, everyone was involved in it. That has not happened with Afghanistan. The fact that we have a military that is basically a professional military doesn't involve anybody individually, but there's been so many people involved in it now because it's gone on for so long, people really, I think, are beginning to wonder what the heck is going on here. So you really have to look back, I think, at least to the 19th century, the 1840s in the British Empire, to understand what is really involved here.
So let's get to that chapter of history. I mean, considering that this is currently the longest war the U.S. has ever waged, that means that we've been in Afghanistan officially longer than the U.S. was in Vietnam. And of course, bringing up Vietnam is an interesting point and a segue into that history, because it was the intention of the United States under President Jimmy Carter to fell the Soviet Union by giving it a Vietnam-style war, but in Afghanistan. So let's talk about that. How, from what you know of the history, how did the U.S. first get involved through the sending of weapons to fundamentalist groups as a way to bring the Soviet Union, which of course is very geographically close to Afghanistan, into that country all the way back to 1979?
Jimmy Carter got elected and brought Zbigniew Brzezinski in as his national security advisor almost from day one. The organizing of one of the theses that Brzezinski worked with was the idea of using the fundamentalists and the Muslims to agitate, especially on the Soviet Union's southern border. And they intentionally were trying to cause, that was all part of the beginning of trying to tricked the Soviets into Afghanistan. So that really started up within the organizing for it, certainly started up almost immediately, that it was as if the plan clearly had to have been hatched. I think part of Brzezinski being there was to actually carry this out. And Carter clearly seemed to help facilitate the ease with which Brzezinski was able to carry this out, which included covert operations that Brzezinski ended up being in control of. And so we have a lot of evidence to really look at the activity that really preceded the Soviet invasion itself that guaranteed that the Soviets ultimately would cross that border. And right now, the fact is that the evidence is very clear that if the provocation had not happened, the Soviets would not have crossed that border.
And that sparked the history then as it unfolded, right, with the U.S. pouring weapons and money through the CIA into the hands of these militant groups, these fundamentalist groups that were called the Mujahideen, the Soviet invasion and occupation lasting about a decade, then the Soviets leaving, then the once allied forces turning upon one another with U.S. weapons, destroying Afghanistan in a civil war and laying the groundwork for the Taliban to emerge from Pakistan. And then, of course, the rest is history, as they say, with the September 11th attacks and the ensuing U.S. war in Afghanistan. Tell me how this history, some of this history is being rewritten. There is now an attempt to say that, well, actually, the U.S. didn't lure the Soviets. They would have gone into Afghanistan anyway.
There was an important interview that was done by a French journalist in 1998, and in Nouvelle Observatoire of Zbigniew Brzezinski. And Brzezinski came out and admitted, yes, we did lure. Up until now, this has been a great secret held by everyone in the U.S. government. But the fact is that we did set out in July. There was a finding given by President Carter in July of 1979 that would basically intentionally lure the Soviets into their own Vietnam. So that has been a bone of contention for some time. When our book came out, we used that in our book, and a number of other people have used it as theirs, as evidence that it was a premeditated attempt by the United States and Brzezinski specifically to lure the Soviets into their own Vietnam. And so it had been denied by the government up until then. And when our book came out, Dr. Charles Kogan, who was the chief of the Bureau of, he was the chief of the Near East Bureau at the CIA, basically came forward at our event and said, I believe everything you've been saying about is true. The Soviets really didn't want to invade. But the fact that this Brzezinski thing, that really is just an exaggeration on somebody's part, on this journalist's part. Well, what he did was a few months later, Kogan actually came up here to Cambridge. And he actually got a chance to speak to Brzezinski, and he told Brzezinski that he didn't believe that particular story from the report. And Brzezinski said, "Oh no, it's true. It's actually quite true. We did intentionally lure him in, and we did things over at the White House that you didn't know about at the CIA." Well, here's the chief of the operation for 5 years, who's running Operation Cyclone, I believe is what they called it, and his whole idea has been thrown out the window. So compartmentalization prevented the CIA from even knowing all the things that Brzezinski was ordering other groups, actually Pakistanis and other freelancers to go into Afghanistan to do. So their objective was to lure the Soviets into Afghanistan.
And the important thing to realize is that the entire basis on which, once the Soviets crossed the border and President Carter announced it was the greatest threat to peace since the Second World War, he established a narrative on the basis of giving the impression to the American people that this was a shocking event and it was threatening and dangerous and they were on their way to the Persian Gulf. All of that was completely, it was like a script that had been written clearly years before. And that's where a lot of the intrigues that were going on between Brzezinski and Carter, who was helping facilitate all of this, that was guaranteeing that the Soviets, number one, this is an important point to make actually about Carter. Carter was actually elected in 1976 on a peace platform. After the Vietnam War and the catastrophe and the effect it had, the realization was that the economy was in very difficult shape, and it was actually Main Street that was in trouble. And there needed to be a total reinvestment of Main Street. And that was going to be facilitated by the peace process, because we were going to be able to spend a lot less on arms and development for arms and put it into the Main Street economy and rebuild, and infrastructure needed rebuilding. So this was what was being pushed. And Jimmy Carter gets elected to push the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, which had already gone through. He was the third president involved in it. And he was also going to be pushing detente to get better relations with the Soviet Union. But the real evidence shows that Carter clearly never intended to fulfill that obligation, that from the very start, he was facilitating Brzezinski's ability to start the agitation process that would eventually lead to what it did lead to, was the Soviets being tricked in. And the reason that's so important is because it totally challenges the perception that actually has taken hold. But this one piece of evidence that Brzezinski created in 1998 has clearly been a troubling piece of evidence, even though there really is a lot of documentary evidence that you can go to.
Why is this history? I mean, this, you were talking about something that happened decades ago. Why is this relevant today? The U.S.'s involvement in Afghanistan is something that continues, but seems cut off from the fact that the Soviets, were felt obliged to invade Afghanistan when they saw the U.S. arming jihadis there.
Well, I think
there's an institutional need to demonize Russia. Mm. I think, and this is why we go back to the 19th century, because back then there was no Soviet Union until 1917, 1918, the Bolshevik Revolution. But we need to go back to demonize Russia in order to justify warlike actions against Russia. And so that's what's been going on ever since. Russia has a lot, Russia lives in that part of the world, has a lot of influence in it. And the United States has picked up the interests of the British Empire from the 19th century and is continuing there. There used to be a program called the Forward Policy. That's what Britain was doing in the 19th century and early 20th century in Afghanistan. They finally came up against the Soviet Union and said they agreed that there would be they'd use Afghanistan as a neutral buffer state.
It was Russia then.
But that's what broke apart during the Carter administration, the fact that Afghanistan was no longer considered a neutral buffer state. And that began the launch pad for whole kinds of things. And the fact is that is really still operational. I mean, this whole concept of peace talks with the Taliban, that's like having that's like two puppets having a talk with each other instead of the puppet master. The puppet master in this particular case is the Pakistani military and their intelligence operation, the ISI. So, the idea that the fact that if you go in there as a mainstream media person and you buy the narrative, then the narrative is going to be endless. It's never going to end if you don't look behind it. That's what we did with Crossing Zero, our book Crossing Zero, the second book we put out in Afghanistan, and that's what we tried to say is that if you really want to understand what's happening here, you have to look at Pakistan and what Pakistan's objectives are. And that's where it gets, they're carrying on what the British Empire was doing in the 19th century. So it's all behind the curtain.
I'd also like to add that in particular, though, I really do think that the interview that Brzezinski gave, and the reason that it is actually being targeted now, is possibly because Brzezinski, number one, died 3 years ago. So I think what we're really witnessing is probably the ongoing narrative reconstruction project that probably historically has been going on for a very long time, and that it is a very elaborate process. I mean, the individual who wrote the paper trying to claim that the interview that Brzezinski gave was actually not enough to prove that he really did trick the Soviets in, also went on to claim that since there's no other evidence, which is unbelievable because there actually is enough evidence even without the interview. So it seems to us that this may very well reveal the process. I mean, why is it that they can't rewrite, for instance, the JFK assassination? Is because it's still too alive. But I think that in the case of other events like this long ago event with Brzezinski, and even though it's actually not, it's actually newer than obviously JFK, but the focus on it is clearly not as intense. So I think that they just think they can get away with it.
And is it? I mean, it seems as though the CIA pouring weapons into the hands of unsavory characters, non-democratic-minded figures, is very much consistent with the history of the CIA, not just in Afghanistan, but in many countries around the world, not just in the late 70s and early 80s and throughout the 90s, but today as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. There's no question it's a pattern. But another aspect to this that we really need to make sure is included is the basically the drug running, okay, and the whole nature of what happened when the United States moved from the Golden Triangle out of the Vietnam War into the Golden Crescent, which is where Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran became drug central. Okay, so that is very critical to understanding the underlying complexities that are...
So you're talking about the fact that a lot of these mujahideen grew poppies and sold opium to finance the wars that the CIA had helped them begun, and that the CIA knew about this, sort of facilitated it. And we also, there's been books written about the U.S. And the Taliban with essentially drug money fueling the current war as well, right?
Exactly. Well, this is the point, though, about the complexity that I think is really difficult for, you know, the average American to begin to grasp, is that the underlying purpose, probably for Afghanistan to even to have been targeted at all, was really the movement of the drugs. A second, the idea of actually drawing the Soviets in and using that as a cover, effectively, but also technically they like to boast winning the Cold War. That was the big deal. And that actually became, we believe, one of the motivators for people like Charles Cogan, Dr. Cogan, the story that Paul just told you about, okay, where he went around and actually claimed that that interview was not true. And when he actually sat down with us and told us on a camera that, you know, he had talked to Brzezinski and found that it was true, and that would have been, I think, 2009 when that happened, he clearly didn't want that to be the truth, or at least he didn't want it public. We certainly can be sure of that. And I think that's partly because of the whole narrative creation process is part of what the mechanism to keep the American people going along with this insanity. They keep convincing Americans that they're doing it for freedom for women's rights. I mean, there is nothing that was more tragic than to see what happened to the real women's rights that were emerging in Afghanistan in the 70s very, very clearly and very vibrantly, and had been actually starting going back to 1923 when Amanullah created the constitution that gave women the right to vote. So you've got a lot of evidence that they, you know, that everything actually has been completely reversed. So whatever the U.S. is claiming, it's clearly the narrative that they're keeping the Americans completely wrapped up in, and nobody has any idea what's really going on at all, right, except for the question, how can we have been there for 19 years and it's still such a tragedy?
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us today. Is there a website where people can find out more about your writings?
Right. It's invisiblehistory.com.
And we'll post a link to, we'll post a link to that from our website, invisiblehistory.com. My guests have been Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. They're longtime journalists and documentarians covering the U.S. wars in Afghanistan. They're the authors of Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, and Crossing Zero, the AFPAC War at the Turning Point of American Empire. We've been discussing the 19th anniversary of the U.S. war in Afghanistan and how the role of the U.S. goes all the way back to Carter. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump, still strong on steroid and antiviral medication and still contagious with the coronavirus, has announced that while he is recuperating from his illness, his campaign will resume its trademark MAGA rallies. The president ought to be worried, considering that numerous polls show him trailing his opponent Joe Biden, even in battleground states like Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. But Trump has another ace up his sleeve. He is amassing what he calls his army of supporters to be poll watchers on election night, a thinly veiled attempt at calling up paramilitary-style groups of armed vigilantes to intimidate Democratic voters. My next guest immersed himself in what he calls the upside-down world of Trump's MAGA rallies, attending 8 campaign events in 8 states over 3 months. Carl Hoffman is author of the New York Times bestseller Savage Harvest, former contributing editor to National Geographic Traveler and Wired, and has traveled on assignment to 80 countries. He joins me to discuss his newest book called Liar's Circus, A Strange and Terrifying Journey into the Upside-Down World of Trump's MAGA Rallies. Welcome to the program, Carl.
Thanks so much.
So first, let's talk about the feel at these rallies. These have been a signature of Trump's for more than 4 years. It is where he seems to be in his element. He is surrounded by adoring fans. What is it like being among these adoring fans? And, you know, what is the atmosphere like?
Well, I think the rallies, I mean, everybody knows how important they are, but I think they're even more important than most people think, and that the rallies are his very lifeblood, really. And that when you go into these rallies, first of all, people begin gathering, you know, days before showtime. Showtime might be at 7 p.m. on any given day, and easily 50 odd hours before that, the first people will begin lining up, and that group will begin to grow, and it's sort of a symbol, a forewarning of this power that's bubbling up as people, more and more and more people gather. And then by day of, even by 6 or 7 a.m. of the day of a rally for a 7 o'clock showtime, there could be thousands of people out there. And then, of course, what's happening in the rallies themselves, this massive sound, wall of sound, rock and roll music, and it's an overwhelming sort of overwhelming atmosphere of people, mostly white people, who are celebrating their togetherness and their love for President Trump, and it's his very lifeblood.
There are people that you met who have been to not one, not two, but dozens and dozens of these. Tell me about the mega fans.
Well, there are quite a few people. I mean, you go to these rallies, and there are traditionally before COVID, there would be sort of two sizes, 20,000, 22,000 people, or a 10,000 person rally in much smaller arenas. And as I said, people get there, you know, days ahead of time. And at the very head of the line, the first 10 people, first 20 people will be people who have come from all over and go over and over and over again. People like Rick Snowden, a former strip club operator who's been to over 60 rallies, or Rick Frazier from a former retired a metal worker from Ohio, union walkaway Democrat who's been to over 24 rallies, a guy named Randall Tom who's been to going over 50. I mean, there are a lot of these people, and they go from rally to rally. And I think what people don't understand is the level to which the people become obsessed with Trump and love him so intensely and passionately. You know, he'll be talking, and there'll be a moment at a rally, and there'll be a moment of silence, and a gruff male voice will call out, "I love you." Or, you know, I was in line 50 some hours before Trump in Tupelo, Mississippi, and I was number six in line. And one at a certain point, this guy who had been one of the construction workers setting up the fencing was driving out, and he paused to talk to us super fans sitting there. And I mean, I wouldn't have believed this if I hadn't heard it myself. He said, "I would walk behind President Trump and pick up his poop if he asked me."
Wow. Well, among those gathered outside Walter Reed Hospital, where Trump was getting treated before he checked himself out, there were people who could be heard on camera yelling, "I would die for you." So, you know, many people have compared Trump's supporters to members of a cult. And if you're a member of a cult, it's very difficult to convince a cult member of reality, of truth, of facts that undermine a worldview that their leader has built up for them. What were the conversations that you had with Trump supporters? You write in your book, quote, "I had imagined having deep conversations about policy and values with people I'd meet, but that was impossible. How could you have a conversation with someone who believed that John Podesta tortured babies and drank their blood?" Was that basically the sort of thing that you experienced?
Yeah, completely, and over again. And, you know, I, going into this, I thought things like Pizzagate and the Frazzle Drip video, that's a video in which you can hear John Podesta, for instance, you can hear the babies in the tunnels crying out.
Oh my goodness.
As Podesta tortures them. And that those things were, and QAnon were these, you know, fringe events, these crazy fringe things that a minority of people believed in. And I found that not to be true at all. I mean, there's this jumbotron that goes up on the day of the morning of the rally, like 7 a.m. It goes up in the parking lots before rallies, and it's on an hour-long loop. And during, this is in September, October, November, December, Brad Parscale, before he lost his job and then got taken off to jail, there's this moment in which he says, literally, "The greatest threat to American democracy or to America is the fake news." And that is just a really kind of clear example of something that's said over and over and over again. And it's said by Trump, and it's said by Trump's people, and it's said by people, you know, talking heads, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or, and, you know, it's just repeated, and it's been repeated for so long that people literally don't believe. I mean, people don't read newspapers. That's why people like, you know, I can't have conversations with people who, you know, they don't read the news, and they believe that the news, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Economist, I mean, the Wall Street Journal even, are these organs of sort of the deep state that are dedicated to putting out everything they can to defeat Trump, and just for ideological reasons, and that none of it is true. And that QAnon and that, you know, the Q clock and all of these things are true. And it's mind-boggling. And, you know, you start talking to people and they say, a lot of people don't even watch Fox News. I mean, you know, they watch.
Even Fox News is too factual?
Yeah, Fox News. And, you know, there's a few liberals who get on Fox News sometimes too.
Right. You know, and then you have people like Chris Wallace, of course. Yeah.
Sure. And what you, you know, what you hear people saying a lot, and again, this isn't fringe. You hear all the time people will say, "Well, I do my own research," and that's like the worst thing to hear, because all you get is you know, people whose exclusive news, so-called news, comes from social media. It comes from Facebook and Twitter and, you know, 4chan, who knows what else. And, you know, we all know what kind of a news source that is.
So
people have no, you know, that's why I call it an upside down world, because right. it's completely a world in which, you know, for instance, me, you know, when I'm in it, I mean, I'm just, you know, you're gobsmacked.
Do Did you find yourself being lured by the by the cult of Trump when you're there? I mean, it's very human nature. There's a reason why human nature succumbs to the kinds of pressures that one faces when one is in that sort of mob-like environment where there's this shared reality.
No, I didn't. I mean, for lots of reasons, but I did feel, especially my first rally was in Minnesota, Minneapolis, in October, just a year ago. And then I went to one in Dallas, and those first rallies, like, I hadn't met anyone, I didn't know anyone. And I felt this intense loneliness that, and sort of remove and apartness from everybody. And I was like frantically texting my children and friends and trying to sort of make this contact. And I had this sense for the first time in my life of what it might be like for people who do get sucked into cults. You know, all I really had to do was to put on, you know, MAGA gear and join and say Trump is the greatest president ever. And all I want to do is win, win, win. And I would be part of it. As it turned out, I started burrowing my way in, and I, like in Tupelo, I was the sixth in line, and I became friends with these guys who were up there on the front lines. And you know, literally we were texting each other from rally to rally, and say, you know, they'd save a spot for me. And then it became, there was sort of a midpoint in my journey during which it was almost fun. Like, in, you know, I arrived in Sunrise, Florida. It was warm. There were palm trees. You know, we spent several days just sitting in the parking lot. And, you know, it's visiting, talking, and not even talking about politics, really. And, you know, I was like part of something, and it was kind of this embrace. But then, you know, I realized that it was so empty, and it was so wrong, and it gave me this profound kind of exhaustion, to be honest, and feeling that I was desperate to escape from it.
Was there a sense that you got of palpable potential for violence? There have been a lot of moments during Trump's rallies where, of course, he has egged on violence, he has encouraged violence, he has fomented violence. The day before he was diagnosed with COVID, he was essentially, you know, giving a green light to a lynch mob against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and refugees like her who would be invading American suburbs. And every now and then we've had brave activists, critical of Trump, going in, who have been beaten up, and journalists have even been pushed around. Did you fear that violence could break out at any moment?
You know, in a weird way, I have a complicated answer to that. And my initial response is no, I did not. Of course, I'm a white male, and I didn't feel, even as a writer, a journalist, I mean, I would identify myself, and people were, you know, unfailingly kind to me, actually, and pretty open to me. And, you know, there's a feeling of festivity at the rallies. That said, there is this undercurrent that is more slightly sinister, because it's a celebration of homogeneity, really. And there's this, you know, Trump vilifies anyone who's an other. And that, you know, after listening to it over and over again, you have this sense of, you know, what would happen if he suddenly said, not just implicitly, but explicitly, kind of go get them. But then there's another level entirely, and that is what struck me in the rallies, and from my very first rally, and I think this is related to what we've seen over the last few days at Walter Reed and his escape from Walter Reed, is that Trump on the podium is strong. He's big and strong, and it's not something that I wanted to see or even really expected to see. But from my very first rally, I felt his strength, and I felt his power and his desire to, you know, this sense, this giant ego that was unleashed by the position he was in and by thousands, tens of thousands of people going Trump, 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 and calling out his name, and that this for this person who had no real moral or ethical grounding, and who, for whom power and his own personal kind of narcissism is everything, that that was such a powerful drug that he would stop at nothing to not have that. And I think that that's what we've seen over the last couple of days. You know, when COVID hit in March, his rallies were stopped, and he kind of faded away. Like he looked feckless. His that bigness, that strength kind of faded away in our eyes. And, you know, he tried to have so-called, he had his White House, daily White House corona briefings, and people said, oh, those are like rallies. But they weren't rallies. You know, they were in front of skeptical, cynical journalists. And he kind of started to fade. And then came the convention, and he just said, forget it. I can't. I must be, you know, he's like a balloon with a hole in it. He was deflating. And suddenly on August 27th, he had, you know, 1,500 people in the Rose Garden, and you know, social distancing be damned. And from that moment on, he sort of started to rise, and he had 16 rallies from between them and then his diagnosis with COVID. And those rallies started to grow and grow, and the numbers were swelling, and he began to rise. And we see that. And so suddenly being holed up in Walter Reed, hobbled with a disease, you know, not being that strong man, he had to change that. And I think that's what he's trying to do.
I'm sure that when the conspiracies started trickling that Trump's COVID diagnosis was a lie to get him out of an election he knew he was losing, you probably knew that it was exactly not a lie, because, of course, getting a disease, Trump knows, makes him look incredibly weak. It was, in fact, the last thing he wanted. And, you know, obviously it came out, so he announced it. And the fact that he has taken, you know, wasted no time in attempting to appear well when, as a man in his 70s who has gotten the disease, you would expect him to not risk his life, but he seems desperate for a resumption of campaign activities because, as you've said, it's his lifeblood.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's that balloon with a hole in it, and his personality is his emotional state. I mean, and this is something I gleaned from watching him over so much time and listening to him. You know, it's the crowd that's giving him that, and he, and it goes both ways. You know, he can see the crowd can see him. The lights are always very bright in the rallies for that very reason, because he wants to see the crowd. The crowd wants to see him, and we want to see both of them interacting. And it's that moment that's sort of the authoritarian moment, and that it's getting worse, I think. You know, as he is under more and more pressure, and as he's from all directions, you know, from Biden and from COVID and from literally COVID, from getting sick, he becomes more and more desperate to stoke the crowds and look big again.
How much of the sense of camaraderie and solidarity among Trump supporters at his rallies was premised on hating liberals?
Well, it's all premised on us versus them, on us versus the other, and liberals are part of that. It's not just liberals. I mean, it's liberals, it's you know, immigrants, it's communists and socialists. I mean, they're not even called liberals anymore, you know.
Right. Liberals is too kind a term, I think, for
yeah,
them.
When Trump
Antifa.
Speaks, well, it's not just that, it's communists. I mean, he literally used the word, you know, communist, socialist, Marxists. You know, there's no middle ground with Trump. You know, he has to kill everything. You're either with him entirely as a sycophant, or you're to be trampled and run over and killed by him. Wow. And, you know, at the rallies, you know, that's a big thing that is less talked about. But, you know, there's always the if he's having a rally in Texas, for instance, there are all these people from, you know, the polls from Texas. I mean, there's Ted Cruz and there's Rick Perry and, you know, the lieutenant governor and all the GOP down ballot. And he'll pause in the middle of this speech and he'll tell a story. He'll call people up or out, these people, and he tells a story about each one. And he's a masterful orator, and he'll tell the story always about how he defeated that person and now they're very loyal. And it's and as people scream and shout Trump, 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 and it's all about power, and it's a display, and it you know, he's saying to these people that I can give you these people, these 20,000 people screaming my name, but I can also withhold them. I can also take them away.
So when we are watching all of this play out on our screens, does it seem to you that the people that show up at Trump's rallies are typical of his supporters? I mean, there's something between 30 to 40% of the nation that is solidly behind Trump, a terrifyingly high number. Or do you think that the people who are at Trump's MAGA rallies are on one end of the spectrum of Trump supporters?
No, I think they're pretty typical. I mean, they're pretty typical Trump reporters. I mean, Trump supporters. I mean, obviously there are, you know, rich Connecticut, Greenwich Republicans who vote for Trump because they're just trying to protect their money, and there are outliers all the time, you know, at every sort of piece of it. But the bulk of Trump's base are classic, you know, your classic white, blue collar, you know, non-college educated white men, and they're women. And I like to say that because there are a lot of women at his rallies, and women can be incredibly vociferous, vocal supporters of Trump. But I always had this feeling that so many of them looked at, I mean, you know, in the end, the things that drive people to Trump are all these cultural things. I mean, race, religion, ideas of masculinity and work. And I think, you know, these are people, again, we're stereotyping a little bit, generalizing, but are people who are, you know, classic blue collar workers with very much more traditional ideas of gender, and, you know, their partners buy into that to a large degree, even though they may be working and that work may be required to keep the family going.
Well, finally, Carl, I wanted to pose a question to you about how you think Trump has influenced America. I mean, obviously, there's always been a faction in America that has been racist and has adopted white supremacist views. It's part of the history of this country. And some have suggested that Trump has simply awakened that and made it okay again. But I'm wondering if his influence as an authoritarian leader has whipped up more hate than previously existed in 2016.
Oh, for sure. I mean, no question about it. I mean, Trump is both, you know, he's the chicken and he's the egg. Mm. I mean, you know, there were these trends that were happening for a long time. I mean, the Republicans have been, you know, using dog whistles and race for years, for decades, you know, since Lee Atwater. I mean, I look at Willie Horton and you know, things that that talk show hosts have been, talking heads have been saying, and Fox News has been doing for years and years and years. But then Trump came along and, you know, really stirred it up and really exacerbated it. And, you know, he gave people permission when he said, you know, we're tired of being politically correct. He gave people, he, you know, maybe people were thinking that, you know, it wasn't okay to be a racist anymore. And suddenly it was like he was saying it was okay. And that's why people love him so much. And he says anything. He's absolutely a shameless liar. I mean, that's the other thing you take away from his rallies. When you're there, it's just he'll say anything. And because he's willing to say anything and he doesn't feel any guilt about it, he says whatever a lot of people who are hurting need and want, people who are feeling a sense of vertigo in a changing world.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Carl. Appreciate your time and your analysis here. Good luck with the book.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
My guest has been Carl Hoffman. He's author of the New York Times bestseller Savage Harvest, former contributing editor to National Geographic Traveler and Wired. He's traveled on assignment to 80 countries, and we've been discussing his new book, Liar's Circus, a strange and terrifying journey into the upside-down world of Trump's MAGA rallies. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kits Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
For survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, wanna drive out to Seattle, where the record
stores. Portland.
Do you believe in the power of community radio? Then show your support by donating to KBOO today. We have a fundraising goal of $80,000, and we need listeners like you to help us get there. Show your support for non-commercial, people-powered community radio by going to KBOO.fm and click